Good morning. The indictment of Bill Cosby came just as last year was ending. While the accusation of sexual assault presents an uglier side of the comedian, it also brings up how tough it is to still bring a case of rape. Law School specialist Ken Lawson weighs in. And as promised, news analyst Neil Conan is back with a few fearless predictions from the farm and a little less alliteration. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Arts Maui put on its first exhibition in 1979, has been taking Valley Isle artists into a world-class arena ever since. And if theater plays it safe all the time, it can't grow. The Maui Fringe Theater Festival 2016 is on to make sure that never happens. We'll hear from organizer Michael Puglia.
It's Tuesday, January 5th. Stay here for the conversation. Now, the news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
Whenever you hear about a woman bringing a charge of rape, you have to wonder if she knows what she's getting into.
Well, she is very often told many things about what she may be getting into.
Yeah.
And the reason we're talking about this, because obviously, as we know, for decades, accusations of sexual assault have chased Bill Cosby. And as the last year came to a close, one case brought an 11th-hour indictment before that 12-year statute of limitations expired. Now, celebrity aside, though, we wondered how tough it is to bring a case of rape and if many of the issues that victims have faced in past are still barriers. Ken Lawson teaches criminal procedure, criminal law, and evidence, among other things, at the William S. Richardson School of Law at UH, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Chris and Beth Ann.
In looking at this case and the way it came about, I mean, literally at the 11th hour of the 11th hour, is this a signal that the prosecution really believes that it has enough evidence to be able to get Bill Cosby after all of these years when we've heard accusations now for decades?
I think that the public perception that Bill Cosby, we know where there's smoke, there's fire, that he's probably committed this offense along with all the other allegations. I think that this prosecutor obviously believes he has enough evidence to bring the charge and get a conviction. And he may not be that far off. These are tough cases, but if the reputation is that you've been doing this for decades and there's other evidence to prove you've been doing it for decades, it's not far off. But getting back to your original point, these are hard cases, especially if a victim doesn't come forward immediately. And many victims don't come forward immediately for a lot of reasons. One, embarrassment. Sometimes they feel like it's their fault when it's not. And other reasons. So when there's no physical evidence, right, of any sexual encounter, no eyewitnesses to right, it's just your word against the other person's word. These are tough cases to bring.
In this he said, she said situation, though, there are obviously other parts to this, including the factor of drugs. How do you assess that when you're talking about someone who was voluntarily in someone else's home, who believed that he was a friend, a mentor, those words have been used, and, you know, is maybe sitting down for a friendly drink and maybe it sort of slips into, well, let's do something else?
Well, that and the perception, you know. When you talk about whether or not a victim gave consent, from dating in high school all the way up to however old we get, you never really say, you know, do I have your consent to have sex with you? There's certain, you know, there's just certain things that happen. You know, I sit closer to you. You come closer to me. I put my hand on your knee. You start rubbing my, you know, and one thing leads to another. And so most individuals will say, well, you know, you were going over to his house. You knew he was married. You started drinking with him. What else did you expect, right? And so what the victim is saying is, hey, you know, I didn't expect this. But the perception could be, and another reason why victims don't come forward is because who's going to believe them? Why else would you be there? And that's why some of them, even though they're true victims, believe it's their fault when it's not.
And that has nothing to do with the idea of a rape shield that would bring in any of their past behaviors. This is simply looking at this one isolated instance of why were you there?
This is a totally separate issue. Right? Go back to the Mike Tyson trial. Remember? I mean, Mike Tyson's lawyer was a tax lawyer. But even then, their defense was, what else would you be going in Mike Tyson's hotel room for at midnight or whatever time, you know, that she went there? And it's going to be the same type of defense here with Cosby. You knew he was married. Why'd you go over there? Were you trying to advance your career, et cetera? And now she's got to deal with all that as opposed to saying, well, you know what? He asked me to come over. I went over there. I had a couple of drinks. I mean, you know, this is nothing unusual. Next thing I know, I'm passed out.
If it were not Bill Cosby that we were talking about, would this case be different?
It would still be a tough case to bring because of all the years that have gone by, right? And so when you have no physical evidence, when you have, did you go home and tell anybody what happened? Well, I told somebody 6 months later. So when you don't, it's just your word against the defendant's word. They're tough cases to bring. I think what helps in this case is you have so many other allegations. Now, whether or not those allegations get into this trial is going to be up to the trial judge because, you know, there's rules of evidence that says, look, just because you may have done certain things in the past, those acts can't be used to show that you did it this time. We want you to be tried on the evidence that's coming right now from this victim and not on your past. But there's other ways to get that evidence in.
So what are those ways to make that evidence admissible?
If he says, well, look, you know what, I don't use Quaaludes or another way is to show identity, that there's something unique about this individual, this defendant. He does something unique each time he commits this crime that we can show other incidents where he's used the Quaaludes, used his power, used his prestige to lure women in and then gives them a drink along with pills and then molest them. If we can show that this is unique to this is his MO, his modus operandi, right?
His pattern.
Right, his pattern. Then I can bring it in because I'm not using it to show that because he did it in the past, he did it now. I'm using it to show that this is unique to him. It's like a fingerprint, right? It's so unique to him that we're allowed to bring this evidence in against him.
But a lot of people might say, okay, but the idea of luring a woman to maybe a woman who feels less powerful than a man who might be a manager or might be in another position that she sees as being higher than hers and, you know, offering drinks or offering drugs or anything else might fall into that same type of category as a pattern.
If it was one or two people coming forth with these accusations, then you might have a good point. But when it's like 30-some-odd women saying that this has happened over, you know, decades.
Well, that's unique to Bill Cosby. I'm saying if this were just an average guy, would it be the same thing?
No. I think it would be harder to get that evidence in. I think it would be harder to get. So actually his fame, his being Bill Cosby, his fame is actually now used against him, right? Because once the allegations become public, more victims come forward. Before I started teaching, I practiced law for 20 years. I did a lot of high-profile cases. And any time someone who committed a crime like this, a sex crime, was in their, it became newsworthy. If there were other victims, they came forward once it became newsworthy.
The deposition that was unsealed obviously seemed to help this case move along. Do you expect that there might be anything else that will come out of the woodwork?
Well, that deposition was key because it has Bill admitting to using the Quaaludes. Now, whether you use them for sex or not, now, if I'm the prosecutor, I got you at least one step closer to the allegations that these women are bringing, that they were somehow drugged with Quaaludes. Now I got you admitting that at some point you got them illegally from a doctor, and you weren't taking them yourself. You got them for other people. So I think that's strong evidence.
As you look into this next year when we're going to see this case come to trial, and you say it's going to be very, very difficult, not to put you on the spot and prognosticate, but do you think that because of everything that you've just said, that there might very well be a conviction? As righteous of a case as Bill Cosby's lawyers say they have against it?
I think you're far, far away from a conviction. I think you're far, far away from a conviction. Real far.
Which will certainly make Bill Cosby's lawyers quite happy.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I mean, that's what they're saying, too.
Right, and we don't know what evidence is going to come out. Remember, the O.J. Simpson case started, and then other evidence started coming out after the case started, so we have no idea.
Which is why I was asking you, do you expect that, you know, this is going to bring other things out of the woodwork?
Oh, yeah.
That we haven't even seen yet, despite the fact that it's been, you know, months since we've been talking
absolutely.
About that deposition.
Absolutely. Evidence is going to, yeah, absolutely. I would not be surprised. That's what makes it fun.
Well, depends on what side of the table you're on. Thanks very much, Ken. Ken Lawson is an associate faculty specialist at the William S. Richardson School of Law. He teaches criminal procedure, criminal law, professional responsibility, evidence, and the business of law practice. You're listening to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2. It's now 8:16, almost exactly. Coming up, nurturing and challenging Maui's artists. First, your backyard quiz.
Most of us know about the late Eddie Aikau, the big wave surfer who was lost at sea while trying to save the crew of the Hokulea in 1978. Today's backyard quiz focuses on a younger sibling. He used to live in a house on a Chinese graveyard in Paua, Oahu, and while living there, he had to perform chores around the property, including cutting the grass. Tasks were completed before any of the kids living on the property were allowed to go surfing. His very first surfboard was purchased at a Long's drugstore when he was 12 years old, and older brother Eddie was already an accomplished surfer, as well as Waimea Bay's first official lifeguard. Even though he arrived at the world of competitive surfing a little late, he managed to win the Quicksilver Eddie Aikau Big Wave Contest in 25-foot waves in 1986. So, can you tell us the name of this surfing icon? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right gets the t-shirt. I'm diving deeper, deeper for you. Hi, good morning. I'm Babatunji Heath from The Enablers. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2. Find out more about the show at hawaiipublicradio.org/theconversation. What can an arts organization do to keep the creative spirit alive and growing in its community? Should it promote all artists equally, or should it seek to raise standards, educate, and set the stage for the artistic growth of future generations? Arts Maui was founded to improve public awareness of the island's artists, with the additional goal of challenging its members to keep pushing themselves to a level that invites comparison with any artists anywhere. Arts Maui is preparing a 2016 season, and board member Jim Polin is on the line to tell us about it. Good morning, Jim. How are you doing?
I'm doing terrific, thanks.
All right, thanks for taking the time. Jim,
My pleasure.
I was looking on your website about the whole spirit at which with which Arts Maui was founded, and it was intended to be perhaps a little bit competitive and challenging. Is that accurate to say?
Well, challenging and competitive, certainly, I think many artists are.
Mm-hmm.
Some produce art just for themselves. Some produce to be commercial, to sell and support their lifestyle, and others just want to see where they're at against their peers.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a combination of all three of those things.
Well, one of the comments that was made at the time of the organization's founding, you know, what was it, 78, 79, was that there was a concern that we weren't getting better.
Mm-hmm. And that's one thing that we really encourage for our artists to do who are submitting, is to challenge themselves. This is a chance to present new work And again, I think to bounce off your peers and our jurors are brought from off island. So you get a different exposure level and a different point of reference from the jurors who might choose the selected works for the show.
And
so
now
we encourage them to do new work, experimental work, large work. Schaefer Gallery, we're at the Maui Arts and Cultural Center, is over 4,000 square feet, and it really gives you a chance to submit large work to a juried show that you can't do anywhere else in the state. Our motto is, if it fits through the door, it's eligible.
Now, you're talking about the juried show that is coming up that you folks are putting together in March, and so it's a juried exhibition as opposed to a kind of a catch-all exhibition, right?
Yeah. Yes, it's a juried exhibition, and like I say, there's a different juror every year, and they're always brought in from off island, so they can be not know as many of our local artists, and hopefully just choose what they feel is the best.
Sure. Which, of course, I mean, there's no way to get away from subjectivity in dealing in an area like this, right? But
well, absolutely, and that's one thing that that's really important for artists to understand when they're submitting to jury shows, is it's one person's subjective feelings. So many people will have their, you know, they pour their heart and their soul into their artwork, and if it's not selected, it can be soul crushing.
Sure.
But it's really, you just have to take a step back and say, you know what, I'm doing the best that I can. I'm really trying to do something with my art, whether it's just make something beautiful or make a statement, but it's what I want to do. And just because the juror didn't select it doesn't mean my work is good personally. It just means that particular person, it didn't speak to them.
Well, you know, obviously no one has the goal of crushing anyone's soul, but at the same time, there really is a benefit to objective and constructive criticism of just about anybody's work. Yeah,
absolutely. And we, you know, I personally would encourage people to get their work out there and show it to other people, and constructive criticism is always good.
Sure. At the same time, I mean, you know, that whole idea of how one reacts to criticism, you don't want to, as an artist, put less of your soul into it the next time, right, for fear of that kind of criticism. So how do you strike that balance?
That's hard, and I think what, like I say, what we just encourage people to do is follow what they believe, but and do what is really that you need to create in your own soul, but to be adaptable. I mean, I think that when you're working as an artist, you need to change as you grow. So that's one of the things, again, that we try and encourage, is people not to just submit the same type of work year after year, even if it gets accepted, but to challenge yourself with something new, whether it's a new material or a new theme or something that's experimental. Or we really want you to try and put something out there that you haven't done before.
You know, I also think about, and this is a favorite quotation of mine from Picasso, Jim, who said, "To imitate others is necessary. To imitate oneself is pathetic." And
yes,
he was a pretty active imitator of his fellow artists. I mean, he did Matisse, he did Braque, he did a lot of his contemporaries at one time or another. And in a way, it makes sense in the overall arc of a career like that he's constantly bouncing off new ideas, right? Wherever you get them, that's okay, isn't it?
Well, absolutely, and I think what really works for a lot of people is to see, to get a art vocabulary, and then to be able to transfer that into something that's meaningful to you. I come back with two quotes myself, and one was John Lennon that said, "There's nothing you can do that hasn't been done before."
Uh-huh.
But in reality, maybe you can take something that's been done before and make it your own.
Mm-hmm.
And then a Picasso quote that said, "By the time they figure out what I'm doing, I'm already gone."
that sums him up about as well as anything I could imagine. But that's also, and I'm not suggesting that anyone imitate other artists, but it's kind of the whole idea of not being afraid to draw inspiration from wherever you can find it, right?
Absolutely. And inspiration can come from any sources. And that's what makes building something with your mind and your hands so special, is that you can take inspiration from any source and turn it into something that's creative and beautiful that you've done yourself.
Well, given that you are on Maui, I would expect a lot of the inspiration to be the natural world, the ocean, the islands. You're surrounded by this great work of art called nature all around you, yeah?
Well, you'd be surprised. One juror one time had said, they wanted to do more of an international show, something, work that would be just as well suited to be hanging in a gallery or museum in New York City as it would San Francisco, as it would in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
And his quote again was, if it's going to be palm trees, they better be good palm trees.
Well, I really find it difficult to argue with that, Jim, but we'll look forward to this upcoming show. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you. And just a couple things that I really wanted to mention is that Art Maui is more than just a juried art show.
Mm-hmm.
As a group, we offer scholarships for high school seniors, four scholarships ranging from $2,000 to $1,000, and also the Art Maui website, which is artmaui.com.
Jim Polin is a Maui-based printmaker and a member of the board of Art Maui, whose 2016 exhibit is set for late March. Art Maui's annual symposium is set for February 20th at 2 p.m. in the Maui Arts and Cultural Center's Alexa Higashi Meeting Room, and in it, multimedia artist and interactive designer Maya Marinelli will present creative tools for artists and other creative minds. You can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
It's the middle of nowhere, but who owns it?
When the time is right, we will begin to defend the people of Harney County in using the land and the resources, and that is our intent.
A standoff deep in rural Oregon, a constitutional issue, and a well-armed militia. Who's going to blink? That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
You might think that with Hawaii's geography and the high cost of a college education, there'd be more opportunities to get a UH degree online. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has the reasons why you may have to look to another school for distance learning opportunities. Good morning, Chad.
Good morning, Bethann.
So this reality check hits it in a couple of places, and especially when it comes to budget, but also in terms of planning and meeting the needs of a growing group of people for whom distance learning may be the only way of really accessing a college education. So what gives with the UH?
Well, Jessica Terrell, our education reporter, opens her story with a woman who lives on the north shore of Oahu who is pursuing higher education. But living on the north shore, that's a bit of a drive to Windward Community College or Leeward or UH West Oahu, let alone UH Manoa. So she looked into getting classes at UH Manoa online, but there are only two fully online degree programs at our main institution of higher learning here. That's compared to 16 programs on average at comparable institutions across the country. So even though UH Manoa has made some significant strides in improving this form of distance learning, I mean, for example, just last year there were 10,000 people enrolled in something like 900 courses.
Yeah, a lot of courses.
Exactly, but they still have a long ways to go. The selection is limited. Jessica checked the spring catalog, for example. There's only two undergraduate courses in English, none in math, none in sociology, very few in the humanities. In many ways, we are behind the times when it comes to online learning.
So hasn't the university, though, known this for some time, that they're just not competitive in this way?
Yes, they have. And by the way, distance learning has, in fact, been a priority. And so there's been a lot of programs that are offered through cable TV. But, you know, in many ways, cable TV, I think younger generations prefer online. That's where they spend most of their time, after all. A couple years back, there was an expert that was advising the Outreach College at UH Manoa, which offers quite a lot of online programs. And he made some recommendations in a memo. He suggested, for example, you ought to throw more money into the program. You ought to conduct some market research. You ought to develop some more online degree programs. But little has changed since then. UH says the focus instead has been on budget issues and on taking care of trying to get students to graduate, not necessarily online programs.
Evidently. And maybe puts in question what kind of money went toward that consultant. Anyway, thanks very much, Chad. We'll have another reality check tomorrow. We'll talk to you then.
Of course.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, striving to increase awareness and treatment of kidney diseases affecting 1 in 7 Hawaii residents. Learn more at kidneyhi.org. Support for The Conversation comes from Hawaii Life Real Estate Brokers, a locally owned company serving Oahu, Maui, Kauai, and the Big Island of Hawaii. Listings and information at hawaiilife.com.
Last week, after a conversation about some of the biggest stories of 2015, news analyst Neil Conan promised to return with fearless forecasts for the new year. He joins us now from his Macnut farm on the Big Island, as he does most Tuesdays, and wants to begin with a disclaimer. Okay, let's have it.
No information in the following few minutes should be used as the basis of any wager involving actual money.
In other words, don't hold me to anything I say.
I may make that my personal mantra.
Well, welcome back and Happy New Year.
And Happy New Year to you, Beth Ann.
Okay, so where do you want to start?
Well, maybe with the less than cheery thought that the war in Syria is going to get worse before it gets better.
Well, Secretary of State John Kerry has just convinced most major players to sit down later this month to talk peace. That includes Iran and Saudi Arabia, but Neil, is that now out the window with the new tensions between those two?
Exactly. Probably. The prospects for this meeting were not exactly brilliant to begin with, but just talking to each other was important. Syria is a very complicated place, but right now that war is the focus of the conflict between Sunni and Shia Islam, with the Saudis backing the Sunnis and Iran backing the Shias. That's the same divide that underlies the war in Yemen. It's the major factor in those, you know, simmering disputes in Lebanon. And now it's not just those proxy wars, but rioters in Iran burned down the Saudi embassy in Tehran and attacked a consulate in another Iranian city. The Saudis have cut off diplomatic relations and canceled all flights to and from Iran. Several of their Gulf allies have followed suit. So there has to be real concern now that these proxy wars may erupt into an open conflict between these, you know, these are big powers that, you know, glare at each other over across the waters of the Persian Gulf.
Yeah, and all of this is following the Saudi decision to execute a Shia cleric, one of the 47 people put to death just a couple of days ago. Was this a deliberate provocation?
You know, if it wasn't, it was a big miscalculation. This man, Nimr al-Nimr, was an important leader of the Shias in Saudi Arabia's eastern province. The eastern province is the part of the country that's right on the Persian Gulf. It has most of Saudi Arabia's oil. It has most of the country's industrial infrastructure. That part of the country is also majority Shia. So the Sunni ruling family in Riyadh always worries about dissidents there and about the extent of Iranian influence there. It's very much like the situation in Bahrain, the little island that's right off the Saudi coast in the Persian Gulf. which is ruled by a Sunni royal family with a majority Shia population, a very restive Shia population. When the situation there threatened to get out of hand a couple of years ago at the height of the Arab Spring, Saudi Arabia sent tanks across the causeway to put down the rebellion. So maybe another forecast. Look out for Bahrain to erupt again.
Okay, well, that would be another proxy war. But is there a real danger of open war between Iran and Saudi Arabia?
You know, probably not, but maybe. Two things to worry about. One is sort of a cold strategic calculation. Iran is just beginning to emerge from, you know, 35 years of sanctions that go all the way back to the Iranian hostage crisis. As a result of the deal to rein in their nuclear weapons program, they're about to get $100 million or so, $100 billion or so in frozen assets. They're about to be able to ramp up oil sales in a big way. But right now, their conventional military just does not have anything like the weapons that the Saudis do, you know, the jet fighters and missiles and tanks and ships. Obviously, Iran is a much bigger country than Saudi Arabia in terms of population. It's inherently more powerful. But if the Saudi calculation is that there's, you know, there could be a war sooner or later, sooner suits their purposes better. So, you know, under that theory, the execution of Nimr al-Nimr was a decision to light the fuse. The other part of that passion, of that calculation, the other thing to worry about is the amount of passion that's involved here. There's hatred and fury on both sides of this religious divide. Passions, of course, can fuel small incidents into full-blown crisis pretty quickly.
Now, we've seen lots of those, but all of this is right in the middle of the biggest oil-producing region in the world, and also right where the U.S. Fifth Fleet is engaged in a bombing campaign against ISIS in Syria, Iraq. Well, you know, there's kind of no wonder that we've seen so much volatility on the stock market.
Well, China, too, there. But, yeah, let's not forget that the Russians are in Syria, too. They're allied with Iran and the Assad government. You know, one escalation the Saudis might be tempted to try is to provide the Syrian rebels with portable anti-aircraft missiles. They have not done that so far. Obviously, that would put Russian aircraft at risk as well as Syrian planes. So, you know, it's clearly in the interest of both Moscow and Washington to restrain their respective allies, but sometimes allies, you know, can't be restrained.
Don't we know that one? Now, look, you promised some fearless forecasts, so let's talk about the elections. The Iowa caucuses are less than a month away now, then the New Hampshire primary right after that. National polls are still showing Donald Trump with a strong lead among Republicans. So I got to ask, is Donald Trump going to be the nominee?
Well, you used an important word there, Beth Ann, national polls. It's not a national primary. It's different contests in all the different states, plus, you know, D.C. and Puerto Rico and Guam. But it starts in Iowa, which has a very strange caucus system that we're all going to know way too much about in 3 weeks' time. Donald Trump is not the leader in Iowa. Ted Cruz has a pretty good lead there, and he's thought to be gaining support as evangelicals shift away from Ben Carson as his campaign unravels before our eyes. If Cruz wins Iowa, he gets a bump there, you know, running into New Hampshire. Chris Christie is doing better in New Hampshire. Jeb Bush will put everything he's got into New Hampshire. I'm going to go out on a long, long limb here. I'm going to say Trump does not win Iowa. He will not win in New Hampshire. I don't think he can win in South Carolina, which comes up next. That's probably Cruz country. Then to Nevada, and, well, pick your metaphor. He's going to push all his chips onto the table. If he loses in Nevada, I think he folds.
Okay, so Donald Trump out before Super Tuesday.
That's just a guess at this point, but I think he's going to have a hard time emotionally on a losing streak. New Hampshire is absolutely critical for him.
Okay, now you just mentioned a whole bunch of the others. Ben Carson, one of the poll leaders just a couple of weeks ago, Jeb Bush, Chris Christie, Rand Paul. His dad did pretty well in New Hampshire. John Kasich, Carly Fiorino, Mario Rubio. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. But George Pataki pulled out last week. Do we care about that?
No. People forgot to mention that George Pataki was in this race. He had less than 1% support in the polls.
So if Trump finally fades, as you are predicting, you're going to still stick with who you think you told me a long time ago will get the Republican nomination?
I'm not so sure. Right now, all the energy is with Ted Cruz. Now, he scares the Republican establishment almost as much as Donald Trump does. So if he starts to build some momentum, party leaders are going to do everything they can to try to coalesce around one of the more mainstream candidates, probably Rubio. Mm. Can Rubio then sustain this grind? You forget how long and difficult this is, where he's going to have a hard time in the South, except for his home state of Florida, and he'll have to hang on in the face of adversity and play catch-up until he can reach friendlier territory for a more moderate Republican, relatively moderate. That's the Northeast and the West Coast, the upper Midwest, I guess. And that's a tough road. He's untested in a national campaign, so is Ted Cruz, for that matter. Mm-hmm. But since I'm on the spot, I say he's not able to do it. I say Ted Cruz builds a lead and holds it all the way to the nomination.
Okay, let's flip it over and say, what about the Democrats? Is this going to be a waltz to the nomination for Hillary Clinton?
Well, that was a little easier. Bernie Sanders has only one hope, and that's for an upset win in Iowa. He's about 10 points down in the polls there. Iowa is all about the ground game, getting your supporters out to all these caucuses in what's usually horrible weather. It's hard to believe that Sanders can out-organize Clinton in Iowa. If he does, he gets a bump into New Hampshire, where he has a narrow lead right now. Then it's a contest. I don't think he can win the contest, but it's a contest. If Clinton wins Iowa instead, New Hampshire doesn't really matter to her. She could probably win it anyway, but she can also absorb a loss there. You know, say, you know, I lost to the native son from next door in New mm-hmm. Hampshire, in Vermont, rather. And so I think if Clinton wins Iowa, it's just about a Clinton clean sweep from there.
Okay, just really briefly, what about the Senate and Congress?
Hard to see anyway the Democrats pick up enough seats to take control of the House, but the Senate is up for grabs. A lot depends on who the Republican nominee is and what kind of a campaign he or she runs. You pretty much know what to expect, on the other hand, from a Clinton campaign. If I'm right and she faces Ted Cruz, I say the Democrats take control of the Senate.
So I guess you're saying that we inaugurate a second President Clinton in about a year?
I think that's it.
Okay. Are you going to tell me then who's going to win the Super Bowl?
Well, I know it's not going to be my Giants. So wait till next year.
Famous last words. Okay. I'll talk to you next week. Thanks, Neil.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Neil Conan joins us from his Magnet Farm on the Big Island most every Tuesday. And you can also hear his specific news minutes right here on Hawaii Public Radio. And now a quick trip back to our backyard quiz. Now, earlier we asked if you knew the name of the younger brother of the surfing great Eddie Aikau. Both brothers competed together in 1971, and then in 1973, it wasn't Eddie who won the first surfing contest ever held at Waimea Bay, the Duke. It was also his brother who tied with Mark Fu for the first place in the 1986 Quicksilver Surfing Contest. Even though this Aikau had never surfed Waimea or any North Shore break for that matter, during the winter leading up to the contest, Clyde Aikau won the wave score countback and later was named a surfing legend by the Duke Kahanamoku Foundation. That's the answer we were looking for, Clyde Aikau.
And Beth Ann, Terry Hardbarger of Honolulu knew that because he sold a motorcycle to Clyde back in the 1990s.
I love how we get these stories that weave together.
Everybody, all kinds of connections. And Nick from Kaneohe also had the right answer, but he was a little behind Terry. So
oh,
what
better
are you
luck next
do?
Time.
It is 8:48, and that's today's quiz. If you've got one for us, do send it to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, announcing their annual Literacy Leadership Conference and student celebrations, February 1st through 4th on Kauai, Maui, Hawaii Island, and Oahu. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
It seems odd to call fringe festivals a tradition because they're pretty anti-traditional in nature, but they've been around now for almost 70 years, providing audiences around the world the opportunity to go to the boundaries of what they know as theater and then go a few steps beyond. The shows are so eclectic that something is bound to catch your imagination, and that's the kind of show Michael Pulliam has put together with the weekend-long Maui Fringe Theater Festival 2016. He's on the line to give us a preview. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Chris. How are you?
All right.
Thanks for having me on your show.
Well, sure. I mean, I think that this whole process of going to the fringes is very much part of what keeps theater alive, don't you?
I think it is. I mean, a lot of the shows that have come to our festival over the years find themselves moving on to larger halls, larger theaters. One show ended up doing an off-Broadway run. Some of the shows that started off at the Maui Fringe ended up going to Oahu and other islands. And so it's kind of a launching pad for individuals on their way up.
And in order to create the kind of thing that becomes a fringe festival event, it's sort of you deliberately want to break some boundaries and sort of get into some new territory. So it's very freeing for the artists themselves, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's theater without boundaries, and at the same sense, if you have something that's not a little bit out there, it sort of goes against the grain of what a fringe is supposed to be. There's a lot of ways you could describe it. You call it a passion project. If someone doesn't necessarily enjoy a personal play, mm-hmm. they might call it interesting. But then the person sitting right next to them might say it's powerful.
Yeah.
So it's eclectic in the sense that there's something for everybody. I almost liken it to a buffet. You can be the type of person that fills your plate with one right. of everything, or you can just sample two or three shows. And some people like to make it a full day, and they stay at the theater all day long, and other people, come for an hour or two all 3 days. So you can kind of mix and match and choose whatever fits your life best.
Well, Michael, I always like events where if you don't like something, you're likely to like the next thing.
Right.
Right.
Well, I actually,
to stick around,
my
right?
background with Fringe started with the Chicago Fringe Festival. And in Chicago, they say, if you don't like the weather, just wait an hour. And that's kind of how Fringe is.
Same thing, yeah.
Wait an hour and watch the next show, and perhaps that will be the one that you you love the most.
Well, also, and this applies to all the arts, really, not just theater, but when you look back at really important, groundbreaking works, chances are, when they first came out, they bothered somebody.
Yeah, well, I think the best example of Fringe success goes way, way back to Edinburgh in the 50s, and Graham Chapman and John Cleese mm-hmm. were performing at an alternative site and pubs and bookstores, and they were certainly alternative and on the edge for the 1950s, and of course that led to Monty Python and the vast success that they achieved in the late 60s and 70s.
Yeah, and who could imagine a world without Monty Python?
Absolutely.
And yet, nothing really could have prepared us. That's a good example, because there wasn't a lot of precedent for something like them. I guess the English had that tradition of anarchic humor with the Goon Show and things like that, but it was kind of an extension of things that had gone before, but it pushed boundaries.
Absolutely. We had a show last year called Mandarin Orange that, and you get a lot of these at Fringe Festival solo shows, and she played about 13 different characters, and some, this was a tiny, howly lady from Texas, essentially playing all these different characters as she was living in China. And it was a bit jarring to see her portray all these different Chinese characters. And that's kind of what you get in Fringe, is that, you can read a description and say, I like that, and then you have to go see it and either be impressed or maybe it's not your cup of tea, and then you go see the next show. We've got one this year called Murder, Blood, Bear Story by Caitlin Schiller. She's coming out from L.A. It's quirky. I guess you could call it a comedy drama, but it's really about a fictional character on a quest who decides that she needs to find a bear in the wilds and attempts to do so with blueberries as bait. And it's weird, it's funny, but I think a lot of people are going to love it.
And I would think with a show like that, you would be left with the impression that no other person on earth could have done this particular
show. And I think that's the success of a really good one-person show like that.
Absolutely. There's another one. This is our first entry coming from Oahu called Money Talks, and it's created by Lucy Lynch and Marcia Magger. And they are essentially taking the idea of a TED Talk, combining it with a Broadway musical. These are ideas that you and I would never come up with, but what our idea would be, nobody else would come up with.
Exactly, exactly. Well, certainly I'm looking forward to this, Michael, and you know, as the day gets closer, I want to talk to some of these individual artists, because you found some really interesting people, and now to the point where they find you, I would imagine.
Well, we always go out looking for certain shows. We always have a couple of shows that end up doing another Fringe instead. But then there's always three or four that just show up. We had no idea where they come from or how they heard about us. It's just word of mouth, and a couple of those shows end up being the biggest surprises of the entire festival. You know, wonderful surprises, not just for us at the EL Theater, but the audiences as well.
Well, surprises are what we're looking for, Michael. Thanks very much for talking with us.
And thank you for having me.
Sure. Michael Pulliam is producer of the Maui On Stage production of the Maui Fringe Theater Festival 2016, a weekend marathon of the performing arts, January 22nd through 24th at the historic Iao Theater. And you can find out more about it on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
On the next Freakonomics Radio, should migration be a basic human right?
There are fundamental human rights. Those rights include the right to free expression, they include the right to freedom of religion, and I believe they should also include the right to move about the earth.
The case for open borders, and the case against it, too. That's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
Thursday evening at 7, following With Good Reason.
Beth Ann, thinking about Neil's predictions for the coming year, I was thinking back to the way nominating conventions in the national scene used to be back when I was a kid, where there was some genuine drama. You know, there would be a drafted candidate, and suddenly somebody would make a speech and electrify the crowd. And the complaint has been that their conventions, the nominating conventions, are a lot less spontaneous than they used to be. But there's no avoiding a lot of drama, and at least part of that this coming year.
Well, drama and lots of conjecture, a little fun, maybe some humor, just
some
watching
tragedy.
Certainly for those people who are pulling out, who had any hopes, but then again, someone who says they might just be delusional in some of those cases.
Yeah.
But it is obviously good fun in some ways to watch all this play out, and we're going to have more of that. I'm really interested to see what happens with Donald Trump, and if Neil is right by that.
Super Tuesday,
he will be just a faded memory. Well, hope your memories won't fade, and you'll remember to join us tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock for more of The Conversation. And on our agenda, we are going to continue our pre-ledge look with Maui County's legislative package, and we will check in with Senate Ways and Means Chair Jill Tokuda.
And we'll meet Balinese shadow puppets in the Battle of the Monkey King. If you've got something to say about the show, call us on our talkback line, 808-792-8217.
And if you'd like to be in touch for any other reason, take a look at our archive on the hpr2.org website. You'll find lots of good things there and lots of ways of being in touch.
I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning back here for more of The Conversation. See you then.